Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
When we talk about energy for Alaska, it is going to be all in. It is going to be oil. It is going to be gas. It's going to be wind.
The governor wants to ramp up development of fossil fuels and renewable energy, even if that's a contradiction for some. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 2nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Girdwood's only childcare facility is running out of space.
What do these children deserve? And they deserve to be in a big building that can accommodate their growing needs.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska is growing quickly, so construction jobs are in high demand. 1 in 20 jobs in Alaska are in construction, and with the industry expanding every year, Alaska needs a bigger workforce. The University of Alaska system offers accessible construction management programs, giving students the skills they need to empower Alaska. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
A state regulatory agency has fined Hillcorp $267,000 for making unauthorized equipment changes at Milne Point, one of its North Slope oil fields. The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission memo says that Hillcorp's drilling permit for a well called I-27 allowed for the use of an electrical submersible pump. An investigation later revealed the company had substituted a jet pump without notifying the agency of the change. The memo says Hillcorp has a track record of regulatory noncompliance that includes more than 60 enforcement actions. Regulators found problems at Hillcorp operations in Cook Inlet and on the North Slope. Several of them were for making changes to a permitted plan. At Milne Point, 3 workers nearly died in 2015 after Hillcorp pumped nitrogen down a well without authorization instead of the seawater it said it was going to use. The nitrogen leaked into a trailer where the men were working. Hillcorp says it launched an investigation as soon as it learned of the unauthorized pump substitution. In an emailed statement, the company says it has already begun revising procedures and training. The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission says the steps Hillcorp has taken are too narrowly focused and are unlikely to prevent a similar reoccurrence. Last week, Governor Mike Dunleavy hosted a 3-day conference focused on Alaska's energy future. The conference highlighted the state's efforts to increase fossil fuel production and boost renewables like wind and solar. Climate advocates say that's a big contradiction, but Alaska officials disagree. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports.
Renewable energy and fossil fuels. It often seems like we need to choose one or the other. But last week, Alaska officials made the case that the state needs both.
Alaska is known and will continue to be known as an oil and gas giant.
That's Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy welcoming attendees from around the world to a sustainable energy conference in Anchorage. Alaska is an oil and gas state, he says, but it can no longer only be an oil and gas state.
So when we talk about energy for Alaska, it is going to be all in. It is going to be oil. It is going to be gas. It's going to be wind. It's going to be solar. It's going to be geothermal. It's going to be biomass. It's going to be nukes.
In an interview, Dunleavy broke down his administration's energy outlook. Selling oil and gas has long been a major revenue source for the state, supporting everything from schools to roads. But Alaskans have also always struggled with the high cost of energy at home. Dunleavy says Alaska should double down on exporting fossil fuels outside to bring money in, while at the same time building more renewable energy in-state to lower bills at home.
We want to be a player on the world stage in oil and gas, as well as coal, as well as biomass. Internally, we have to lower the cost of energy and make it stable. And that's where you see a lot of the renewable concepts come into play.
The cost to operate renewable energy projects has dropped dramatically in recent years. Meanwhile, rural communities in Alaska face some of the highest energy costs in the nation, often relying on expensive imported diesel and heating oil. Dunleavy says for him, investing in renewables is not about lowering carbon emissions or combating climate change. It's just about securing cheap energy for Alaskans that's not tied to the volatile price of oil.
From my perspective, if a diesel generator could be producing electricity at a very low cost consistently, we would consider that as well.
Historically, Alaskans have not pursued renewable energy because of climate benefits.
That's Philip White, an energy historian at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
We have pursued renewable energy because it has reduced our reliance on diesel and other higher cost fossil fuels. We've done it for economic reasons, not climate reasons.
White says this has been Alaska's approach for decades. Export fossil fuels for revenue and find the cheapest sources to use at home. But he says as climate change accelerates, this model no longer works. Alaska is facing the growing impacts of climate change, from sea ice loss and thawing permafrost to species die-offs. White argues that as long as Alaska continues to pull billions of barrels of oil out of the ground, the state is contributing to its own environmental problems.
Even if we get cheaper priced domestic energy here in Alaska, we're still exacerbating a global problem, and a global problem where, you know, Alaska is warming four times faster than the rest of the planet. We're not escaping that problem. We're on the front lines of the climate crisis.
Proponents of fossil fuel production point out that there's no clear alternative revenue source if the state ended oil production. But experts like White predict that as the world transitions away from fossil fuels, eventually Alaska will have to stop drilling. Meanwhile, clean energy advocates like Rachel Christensen with the Alaska Center say the state still isn't doing enough to invest in renewables, and they'd like to see the governor do more.
What we're seeing is just talk about the potential of solutions. We need to see him actually taking action on putting those into place.
She points to two proposals that were taken up in the legislature this year. One would require utilities to source a certain amount of their energy from renewable sources, and another would help finance renewable projects in small communities. Dunleavy said he supported both, but neither passed. Christensen would also like to see the administration take climate change more seriously in its energy policy.
It should be more than just an economic move. Our people and industries are already feeling the effects of the climate crisis, and we can't keep pushing these large-scale extraction projects for export just because it's what we've always done.
Christensen says in an era of climate change and shifting global energy markets, what we've always done won't always work. In Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, biologists find opossum offspring on the loose in Homer.
They've been known to have as many as 13. So there's probably a few individuals out there that we're trying to track down.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health. But did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
Finding childcare in Anchorage is tough, with years-long wait lists and rising prices forcing many parents to choose between working or staying at home with their children. In Girdwood, a town about 40 miles to the south, it's even more difficult. There's only one licensed childcare center, and demand is high. And while there's a long-running effort to triple the center's capacity, as Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, time is running out.
It's the first day of the summer session at Little Bear's Playhouse in Girdwood. Kids are decked out in rain gear as they make huge splashes in puddles outside. Little Bear's is a fairly small building, essentially one large room with a wall of cubbies separating the toddler and preschool classrooms. Crystal Hoke is a member of the Little Bear's board of directors. She says the building was originally built as a community center for Girdwood in the 60s.
In 1982, it became the child care facility and has operated as such for 40 years. But now we are at the end of the line for the usefulness of this building.
It's not only too small to meet demand, Hoke says there are also structural issues with its roof, to the point that parents have to sign a liability waiver for their kids. But with Little Bears being the only licensed childcare facility in Girdwood, residents don't have many other options. Executive Director Rachel Byers says demand is high in the town of roughly 2,000 people. Little Bears currently serves 31 kids in the preschool and toddler programs, with a wait list of around 18 kids. Byers says the lengthy wait time discourages many families from even bothering to apply.
And they ask how long it is, and you tell them people are waiting a year and a half to 2 years, which is substantially more than what people are getting in Anchorage. People are just immediately like, never mind.
Many parents, including Byers, have to drive their kids to the city of Anchorage for childcare. If they work in Girdwood, it can mean a lot of time on the road.
45 minutes there, 45 minutes back, 45 minutes there, 45 minutes back. So 3.5, 4 hours a day in the car.
Members of the Little Bears Board of Directors have been working for more than a decade to expand, hopefully building a new center to serve more than 100 kids, including infants. Hoke says the board is closer than ever to reaching its goal. They were approved for a grant by the Anchorage Assembly for $1.6 million in American Rescue Plan Act funding last year. The catch is the board needs to raise funds to match that amount, and Hoke says they've got about a year to do it.
The infrastructure required to build at Southtown site is $4 to $5 million. So we are getting creative as to how we might come up with the solution. But we know that we need more money, we need donations, and ultimately we're going to need more grants to get to where we need to go.
One place the board is hoping to get some of that funding is from the state, where childcare has become a much hotter topic. Governor Mike Dunleavy announced in April that he'd be putting together a task force to address childcare issues in Alaska. Almost 2 months later, a spokesman for the governor said the state is still in the process of appointing members to the task force. Additionally, the legislature appropriated about $7.5 million in grant funding in the budget for childcare, but Byers says the funding isn't really designed for the kind of expansion Little Bears is looking for.
That money would be used to bolster the salaries and increase them. I also believe that this task force is meant to kind of look at how to figure out and help solve problems. So I don't even know if it's really to take action as much to do research at this point.
Byers says Little Bears has already made strides to help retain its staff, including increasing its tuition rate to buff up salaries, as well as providing various benefits to employees.
We did hiring bonuses and incentives and ski passes and commuter stipends, everything we could think of to have people come on.
Their biggest issue is really the space. Board member Hoke says with more capacity at Little Bears, families in the expensive ski resort town wouldn't have as many tough financial decisions.
Far too often, people are removing themselves from the workforce to deal with it.
And while there are economic benefits to expanding Little Bears, Byers says at the end of the day, it's the children who'd benefit the most.
It really shouldn't be anything more than like, what do these children deserve? And they deserve to be in a big building that can accommodate their growing needs and not, you know, inside a building that's from the 1960s.
In the meantime, the kids at Little Bears will continue their summer curriculum, which includes learning about botany and insects, as well as the occasional dancing session. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Aquaculture, or mariculture, is a fledgling industry in Alaska with big potential. The federal government announced yesterday that it plans to help identify areas of Alaska state waters best suited for shellfish and marine plant farms. KSTK's Sage Smiley reports.
Alaska has so much coastline, it's just a few thousand miles shy of being able to wrap around the Earth twice. And the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, wants to help the state of Alaska identify areas along its coast best suited for growing marine plants and shellfish. Danielle Blacklock is the director of NOAA Fisheries Office of Aquaculture.
As a complement to wild-harvested seafood, aquaculture, or mariculture, is vital for supporting our nation's coastal communities and feeding our growing population. In a changing climate, we must look to the ocean for sustainable food as foods from the sea are good for people, good for the planet, and good for the economy.
It's a somewhat new endeavor for NOAA. They're already working to identify what they call aquaculture opportunity areas, or AOAs, in Southern California and the Gulf of Mexico, but those are in federal waters.
Alaska presents a really exciting opportunity to show how dynamic this planning process can be.
During a press call June 1st, Blacklock said this will be the first partnership focusing on state waters, within 3 miles of Alaska's coastline specifically. It'll require collaboration between state and federal agencies.
So that means a true partnership with the state.
Blacklock says Alaska's plan will focus solely on marine invertebrates and macroalgae, since farming finfish in state waters is illegal. She explained NOAA will use environmental, economic, and cultural data to determine the size and location for potential aquaculture development zones.
They will produce a peer-reviewed aquaculture opportunity atlas that shares this data and the resulting maps with the public.
Blacklock says the decision to look into aquaculture opportunities in Alaska comes after public support from Alaska Native organizations, multiple arms of the Alaska state government, and fisheries stakeholders during public comment in 2020. State officials are publicly welcoming the collaboration. They say the rapid increase in aquaculture projects in Alaska necessitates collaboration and new innovative solutions. Sam Raybung is the head of commercial fisheries for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, which oversees operational permits for aquatic farms in Alaska. The state's ambitious goal envisions a $100 million mariculture industry in Alaska by 2040.
The collaborative effort necessary to establish aquaculture opportunity areas will provide an opportunity for agencies and stakeholders to ensure important current uses and activities are identified and considered in advance.
Raybung says a large part of evaluating permit applications is evaluating their proposed locations. Although no areas are off limits, having predetermined opportunity areas will help streamline the process, which involves an aquatic land lease from the State Department of Natural Resources and an operational permit from ADF&G.
We're not interested in leasing or permitting an area that's going to create a conflict. And to me, that's the biggest value of this exercise, is we're going to identify areas of potential conflict in advance so people don't play wrong guess when they are applying for farm sites.
The announcement comes as Alaska is moving to bolster its mariculture industry from within. A bill signed into law by Governor Mike Dunleavy last July expands permitting for farming shellfish like crab, razor clams, or abalone. There's also interest in the environmental benefits of aquatic plants as a way to fight climate change. NOAA plans to finance the science and public outreach through funding already appropriated specifically for use in aquaculture. State agencies will operate within their existing budgets. Plus, there is funding headed for Alaska mariculture, a $49 million grant cluster from the federal government, more than $25 million for mariculture research from the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council, and a $5 million mariculture matching grant from the state legislature. Next is outreach within Alaska communities and organizations. This planning process may take upwards of 3 years, but Blacklock says it's all to feed the growth of a productive and sustainable mariculture industry in Alaska. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska is growing quickly, so construction jobs are in high demand. 1 in 20 jobs in Alaska are in construction, and with the industry expanding every year, Alaska needs a bigger workforce. The University of Alaska system offers accessible construction management programs, giving students the skills they need to empower Alaska. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Local sponsors do right by their business and for the community by supporting public media stations. Thank you for considering adding your corporate support. You'll be in good company.
If you've been grumbling about it feeling cooler than usual in Alaska this spring, you're right. Lingering snow and cloudy days resulted in temperatures about 3.5 degrees below average statewide from March through May. National Weather Service climate researcher Brian Brettschneider, back for our Ask a Climatologist segment, says that ranged from about 1 degree below average in Juneau to 2 or 3 degrees in Anchorage and 4 or 5 degrees in Fairbanks. And Brettschneider says April was a particularly chilly month statewide.
It was the month where normally April is where we transition to spring, but April really was a continuation of winter. So statewide, it was either the 4th or 5th coldest April on record. about 10 degrees below normal. But in much of the central and western interior, it was, 14 to even like 18, 19 degrees below normal for the entire month, which is really remarkable. And even places like even Nome set an all-time lowest temperature record for the month of April. A lot of records were set in western part of the state.
Interesting, yeah. So a lot of people were complaining about that, obviously, but maybe this is a dumb question, but is that just because of cloud cover? Like it just happened to be cloudy, more of the time?
Spring is tough because as we get the sun getting much higher in the sky, particularly in, from mid-April onward, the temperature can be highly dependent on if there's still snow on the ground. So snow in many ways acts like a mirror. It reflects a lot of the solar energy back into space. So if there is snow on the ground, it'll be cooler than the air mass would otherwise let it get to. So because we had a deep snowpack in many parts of the state, it becomes a what's called a positive feedback cycle. We get some below normal weather, and then that prevents the snow from melting. And the fact that the snow didn't melt means that it keeps the weather cooler than it would ordinarily be. So from an atmospheric point of view, we just had a big area of very persistent low pressure that was really stuck over the state and the Bering Sea area. And that just prevented any warm air from moving over the state.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, so how does this spring compare to years past? I mean, some of those numbers sound pretty significant, but in the grand scheme of things, are they?
Yeah. So, when we compare March, April, May of 2023 versus other years, we're going to look back and say, yeah, this was cooler than the normal for the current normal period, which is 1991 to 2020. But historically, this would be actually a pretty typical spring conditions. So so we do have some recency bias to overcome, but we've certainly had some much colder springs in years past.
Yeah, no kidding. I feel like we talk about this a lot too, where what's going on right now or even this past spring doesn't really mean a whole lot, in the long term, summer forecast. And I should say, I feel like we talk about that in regards to wildfires too, because it doesn't take a whole lot of, hot, sunny, dry days to really ramp up that wildfire danger. So just to like make that point.
And to follow up on that, as many people in say the Fairbanks area will remember, 2004 was kind of the wildfire season of record. Well, May of 2004 was the wettest May that Fairbanks had. Anchorage people remember the hot summer of 2019 and, that we were just choked in smoke basically that entire summer. May 2019 was the wettest May on record in Anchorage. So we can get lulled into thinking, oh, well, boy, it's really wet and cool and kind of try to extrapolate that as to what the summer conditions will be, only to be completely wrong.
Well, so is that forecast for June to be warmer than normal, is that based on, shifting into an El Nino pattern?
So there's a couple of things that they look at when making these monthly and seasonal outlooks. And one is they do look at what are called dynamic models, that kind of here's the initial conditions and where do we expect it to evolve over the next number of several weeks to several months. So that's one aspect. Another is they do look at trends, trends in temperatures and trends in, say, sea ice and trends in ocean temperatures and how that would affect. And then they also do look at El Nino, La Nina conditions. Typically in an El Nino summer, Alaska is a little bit warmer than normal, and particularly the western part of the state has a stronger signal for warmer than normal conditions. So all those things go into the pot when they generate a monthly and a seasonal outlook.
Okay. Well, Brian, now I want to play the part of the, cranky Alaskan who felt like their spring was really, really cold and maybe you know, just to understand that I'm just trying to play a character here, but doesn't that mean, since it was in some places significantly colder than normal, doesn't that mean that global warming is not actually happening?
Well, it can be tempting to look outside and you know, while you have your jacket on and maybe even looking at snowflakes falling in summer to say, well, what happened to global warming? But we have to remember that we are, even though we're a big state, the biggest, of course, we are a small part of the globe, and most of the globe is really on fire, in many cases, literally, especially in Canada. And right now, all the buzz in the kind of the climate community is how the oceans are basically just on fire, how Antarctic sea ice is, even though they're in 24 hours of darkness, is decreasing day after day, not increasing. It's really uncharted territory. So we're a little area of cool nirvana compared to everyone else.
That was Brian Brettschneider, a climate researcher with the National Weather Service and the climatologist in these segments we like to call Ask a Climatologist. Well, Homer thought its opossum problem was over last week when a police officer grabbed Grubby. But now biologists say the female fugitive's litter is on the lam. Jason Harriman with the State Department of Fish and Game says Grubby's son was captured alive near Homer City Hall yesterday. Another young opossum has been sighted in town, and Harriman says more are likely to be at large.
Opossums typically have litter size of, say, 8 to 9. They've been known to have as many as 13. So there's probably a few individuals out there that we're trying to track down.
Opossums don't live in Alaska, making Grubby and her babies an invasive species. It wasn't known that Grubby had given birth until recently. She was thought to be solo when she showed up in Alaska in March after hitching a ride in a shipping container from Washington State, and she caused quite a stir. Fish and Game wanted her caught. It took almost 2 months, but eventually police corralled her into a garbage can and she was sent to the Alaska Zoo in Anchorage. Then people in Homer started spotting her babies. Harriman says the one caught yesterday appears to be 3 to 4 months old, which means Grubby likely arrived in Alaska pregnant.
These guys are to the size and age where they should be able to make it on their own just fine, particularly with the conditions we have in Homer and where they're at in town.
Harriman said the young opossums pose the same concerns that Grubby herself did, ranging from spreading infectious diseases to eating indigenous animals. He's worried about them multiplying.
There's plenty of food sources for them. The weather's warm, so unfortunately that gives them a good chance of getting a foothold and establishing a population if we don't manage to track all these guys down pretty quick.
Homer's animal shelter has urged pet owners to keep animals indoors during the live trapping efforts to capture the young opossums. Homer police are asking residents to report if they see any Grubby offspring and say the animals will have a home after they're captured. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin, Kavitha George, Wesley Early, and Chris Clint in Anchorage, and Sage Smiley in Wrangell. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. Public media runs on membership. Thank you for supporting this station with a donation today. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.